You're listening to a podcast from the South China Morning Post.
Today, Japan, South Korea, and Iran reported a sharp spike in coronavirus cases.
As new hot zones reported outside of China, hundreds of cases now in South Korea, and the virus spreading in Europe, and new warning
signs. The coronavirus has spread to countries across the world, but officials believe that it all started in Wuhan, China.
It is almost 2 months since four people were admitted to the hospital in Wuhan with pneumonia-like conditions. All four had worked at the Huanan Seafood Wholesale Market, Huanan Haixian Pifa Shichang. Since then, 48 cities and four provinces in China have issued official notices for lockdown policies, forcing an estimated 500 million people to stay indoors, waiting for the all clear. As I speak to you now, there are over 75,000 cases of coronavirus documented in mainland China, with more than 2,000 people dead. And the effects of the coronavirus continue worldwide.
We're concerned about the number of cases with no clear epidemiological link, such as travel history to China or contact with a confirmed case.
Just as predicted by Dr. Ben Kelly from the University of Hong Kong's Faculty of Medicine last week, we're seeing an increase in the spread of coronavirus in other countries across Southeast Asia.
Unfortunately, I think we still face the possibility that infections have been seeded into other countries in Southeast Asia. I could hypothetically say in a few months' time, will we be talking about closing the border to other countries in Southeast Asia where there's community transmission and epidemics and people are traveling? We've already seen, I think, in the past couple of weeks, South Korea had...
This week, we're seeing reports of a downward trend in new cases of the disease reported. And again, just like Dr. Cowling told us last week, the decrease in the severity of the virus and the rise in people recovering from it has experts talking about the coronavirus being considered more like the flu than SARS.
So what that means is going to be very difficult to control community transmission, because most people, like with flu, most people with the coronavirus would have mild symptoms. Maybe they can take paracetamol so they don't have a fever anymore, then they can go to work, and then you can imagine there's a lot of potential opportunities for transmission to occur.
Welcome to another special edition of the Inside China podcast from the South China Morning Post. My name is Mimi Lau.
And I'm Kinling Lo. And with all our podcasts on this subject, our warning is that this is a story developing day by day. Go to scmp.com for our 24-hour rolling coverage of the spread of coronavirus and the global health emergency. Once again, this podcast comes to you from an apartment in Hong Kong Island, with sounds of trucks, buses, and road work outside, as most of the staff at the South China Morning Post continue to work from home. I say most with a special shout out to our print team, who continue to travel to Causeway Bay every day to ensure the newspaper is being printed and the website continues to be updated.
This week, we're going to take you inside Beijing for an update from our reporter Echo Xie.
There are several drugstores near my neighborhood. All of them don't have the masks. It's such a problem right now for so many people. What I can see, what people are doing around me, like my friends and the residents in my neighborhood, they just try to find masks from other places.
And you're going to hear from one of our China Desk editors, Teddy Ng, on the ongoing political crisis, and that began with the death of Wuhan doctor Li Wenliang, and now includes revelations about how much President Xi Jinping knew about the outbreak and when.
People are questioning if Xi gave the order on January 7th, so why would it take almost 2 weeks for the Chinese government to introduce emergency measures?
But also, you're going to hear about the pushback from people angry at censorship of social media and state-controlled news.
A lot of people are calling free press and freedom of speech. And some people are also calling end of one-party rule.
And how that's leading to some fascinating new ways of sharing information online.
People are emboldened by using a different form of communication. It acts as a shield.
And while the revelations from Wuhan continue, you're going to hear some snapshots of what life is like in the lockdown across mainland China.
Currently, I stay at home in Chongming Island.
I'm on the 7th floor of a building in Shantou.
Currently, I'm at my home, an apartment in Guangzhou.
I am on the 28th floor of a building in Taiyuan City, Shanxi Province.
We have stayed at home for almost 20 days.
And we are going to take you inside an apartment building, where the residents have just been informed that one of their neighbors might have the coronavirus.
So the next day, we found a cordon is put up at the entrance of the building. So there are staff on duty 24 hours to prevent anyone from entering or leaving.
Here in Hong Kong, the government continues to struggle with the growing anger at its management of the crisis. It announced a relief package worth $3.8 billion. Meanwhile, Hong Kongers are angrily protesting outside public housing that has been deployed as a quarantine zone for people returning to Hong Kong who are of high risks of being infected with the coronavirus, such as those who've just returned from the cruise ship Diamond Princess, which was docked in Japan, where 621 cases are already confirmed. And in the past week, they've also witnessed some extraordinary headlines.
Knife-wielding robbers in Hong Kong steal 600 rolls of toilet paper amid coronavirus panic. Hong Kong's supply of toilet paper to improve this week.
The panic buying caused by what the World Health Organization declared as infodemic of rumors and misinformation on WhatsApp, WeChat, Facebook and Twitter continues in Hong Kong.
You're seeing the worst case scenario spreading through digital platforms. People are looking at it and go, we might not have any food, despite institutions saying, no, we're fine, we do have enough. And this is a challenge. So rather than the coronavirus necessarily being the most scary thing, it's the public reaction that should cause you a bit of fear.
And you'll hear some more analysis of why the causes of this panic run so deep and why, after 2 weeks, people are still desperately trying to gather certain products from supermarket shelves in Hong Kong.
This is sort of the perfect storm. So Hong Kongers aren't trusting the national government or the local government, which is resulting in a number of dysfunctional behaviours across the society.
Now, one story you might have missed in the international coverage of mainland China is how a protest chant that we've heard shouted in Hong Kong for several months, five demands, not one less, is now being strangely echoed inside China, inspired by the death of Dr. Li Wenliang from Wuhan. Mimi, you've been covering this story closely. What are these five demands about?
So right after the death of Dr. Li Wenliang, there has been a massive outpouring of anger and grief on Chinese internet because people are realizing the right to free speech is actually not so remote as they once thought. It's actually essential to the right to survival in times of emergency like that. So there have been netizens making these calls. And then we're also seeing some really prominent intellectuals in China taking up these calls and then joining hands with other alumni graduated from prestigious universities, signing online petitions, calling on the National People's Congress to take up on five demands, to take concrete measures to work on implementing freedom of speech in China.
And what are these five demands?
This petition they have signed, addressed to the National People's Congress, lists the five demands for Beijing. That is to protect people's right to freedom of expression, to discuss this issue at the MPC meetings, which has been delayed, and to make February 6th, the day when Dr. Li died, a national day for free speech, and to ensure no one is punished, threatened, interrogated, censored, or locked up for their speech, and to give equitable treatment such as medical care to people from Wuhan and Hubei province.
These are some really strong calls. And so what has happened following their demands?
From what we have understood so far, a lot of these prominent intellectuals who've joined the calls in this petition, they have had their social media account, that is the WeChat account, being suspended. We are still trying to get in touch with them, but so far it has been quite difficult.
And when was the last time we saw such public effort
from intellectuals uniting to criticize authorities.
I would have to say when Beijing scrapped the presidential term limit.
So apart from this joint petition, we've also seen some big names in China who've tried to stood up to the censorship and that kind of pressure in dealing with the coronavirus. Teddy, can you tell us a bit about this?
Yes, there is one interesting development. This Peking University law professor He Weifang wrote a two-page article saying the lack of a free press, poor governance, and an information blackout have all contributed to the spread of the coronavirus. The reasons why Professor He decided to handwrite the article is that he wanted to escape the censorship of WeChat. So he handwrote it and posted it to the WeChat groups, share with his friends. But then the censorship appeared quite strong, and the article was still taken offline.
What is in that letter that's so sensitive that it's being taken down almost immediately?
Well, one of the key points Professor He raised in his article is that he hopes the heavy price of the outbreak will make the Chinese authorities come to realize that without press freedom, people will live in distress and the government in mendacity. And he also said if the media in Wuhan or Hubei could freely report and responsibly, the people would not have to rely on the bureaucracy and live in misery.
I mean, given his prominence in the field, do you think anything bad will be happening to him? Or do you know if he's facing any pressure already?
Right now, we don't know if he's facing any pressure, but that his article, even though it was handwritten, it was taken offline by the social media platform, and then his WeChat account also got suspended. Not only him, a handful of other people, other academics in China who demand for greater guarantee of press or freedom of expression also had their WeChat account suspended for the moment.
So I understand that in his letter, he actually pinpointed something about what Chinese President Xi Jinping has said earlier in January. What was that about?
Yes, indeed. He raised it, Professor He raised a point that about a shocking revelation by the Communist Party General Qiu Shi that Chinese President Xi Jinping had actually ordered officials to do something to contain the outbreak of the virus as early as January 7th. But that Qiu Shi article didn't give any elaborations on, you know, what kind of order Xi Jinping actually gave. So other than just saying that President Xi had issued the directive for the lower level officials to do something on that day, I mean, we are still kept in the dark what these orders actually are.
So Teddy, when we spoke last week, you said that the death of Dr. Li Wenliang has actually stirred a credibility crisis for the Chinese Communist Party. So how do these revelations play into that crisis?
Well, according to some political analysts we have spoken to, President Xi's address was a very rare and interesting shift from the past. They said it is unprecedented. And it sounds like he's defending the Chinese government handling of the crisis and explaining how he has done everything in his capacity to lead the epidemic preventions, because especially after Dr. Li's death, there is still an ongoing outpour of public anger and criticisms against the Chinese government. Many people are asking why there is no early intervention to prevent the outbreak from getting serious. So by saying that he gave an order in early January, political analysts are suggesting that he's trying to deliver a signal that the Chinese government is aware of the problem at an early stage.
So it's not until around early to mid-February that we saw actually a picture of President Xi wearing a mask. What do you think has happened in between from January 7th onwards?
That's what a lot of people is asking right now. People are asking what kind of order President Xi has actually given to lower level officials. And if he has given the order, why the official measures introduced to contain the spread of the virus would take so long? So people are questioning if he gave the order on January 7th, so why would it take almost 2 weeks for the Chinese government to introduce emergency measures. One of the theories they suggest is that the Chinese political system is too bureaucratic. Those lower level officials have to wait for the approval from the top leadership before they start working.
The anger over the death of Dr. Li Wenliang has continued, and that has fueled efforts to defeat China's strict control and censorship of its social media. In fact, it's resulted in this kind of message being posted on WeChat.
Qin Chen is a reporter with the Engstung team working with the China desk at the South China Morning Post. She's based in Beijing and has been reporting on these efforts to beat China's censorship. Qin, you've been following people sidestepping censorship on Chinese social media, right? Tell us about this developer you've been speaking to.
Yeah, this person is a developer. She's in California. She's a Chinese woman. She's 25. And so she was very inspired by all the deluge of posts she saw people posting after the death of Dr. Li Wenliang. And she decided that she could write a program and help people to kind of beat the machine censorship, kind of slowing down the AI programs that can kind of take down your posts after they detected sensitive words.
What kind of words? Give us some examples.
So she said when some people posted, "No, I can not," or "No, I do not understand," those posts would be taken down. But right after the death of Dr. Li, almost all posts would get taken down, as long as they have a mention of Dr. Li or even just a slight trace of saying something regarding to his death or calling for freer speech or free press.
Why would posts containing the term "I know I don't understand" or "no, I would not" would be sensitive?
That's a reference to Dr. Li's own personal experience. He was reprimanded by the Chinese authority after he alerted others about a possible SARS-like outbreak. He was asked to sign a letter by the local police in which he wrote, "Yes, I understand," and "Yes, I can." So a lot of people were angry. So as a protest, a lot of people wrote in, "I cannot understand," or "I cannot do that," as a protest. People use it and they said it was effective for them for a while. Eventually, a lot of their posts were still taken down because when human censors got around, they would discover what is going on. And this website is blocked by China's Great Firewall, the Chinese censorship system, early this week.
So apparently there is this other creative way, which is a Morse code generator, which helps netizens to get messages through. How does that work?
People are using Morse code and sharing a link to decoding their Morse code to kind of avoid the AI censorship. Because if you're typing in Morse code, people and machine sensors won't pick up what you're typing at first without decoding it. So they're assuming that the sensors behind the system doesn't regarding Morse code as a way people would use to communicate.
And are there some popular phrases that have been transmitting around using Morse codes?
Yes. A lot of people are calling free press and freedom of speech. And some people are also calling end of one party rule. Yeah, I think people are emboldened by using a different form of communication. It acts as a shield for them to kind of feel maybe safer that to say what they really want to say and couldn't be able to say for a long time.
Qin, all of this sounds very interesting, but how widely are these techniques being used among Chinese social media users today?
You know, we don't know. That's the problem of censorship, because it takes down a lot of the voices and it makes it really hard for both the people and the system to track just exactly what is the real emotion around people. I think a lot of people are using different ways. They may or may not be seen by everyone. But the real answer is we don't really know how big it is. What we do know is after Dr. Yu Wenliang's death, we're seeing a range of people commenting and angry at the situation.
So how far do you reckon this kind of effort is going to be carried on?
Well, I think it depends on the kind of next move from the government. If people are feeling angry again by other movements from the government, they will probably do similar things again.
2 weeks ago, you heard from our colleague Echo Xie, who was just finishing quarantine in Hebei province. After 2 weeks of being locked inside in her hometown, she finally got onto a train to Beijing and promptly found herself under a new quarantine in China's capital.
Can you tell us, how did you go through that a month? What are the controls that are put on you when you go to Beijing?
That's an interesting question, because I took a high-speed train from Hebei, my hometown, to Beijing, and it's about three hour drive. So when I went on the train, I realized I was treated differently with other people, because the local government has my ID number. And for the first time when I entered the train, I was asked if I went to Wuhan, and I said yes. So I was taken to a separate place and isolated from others. And they asked me to fill in a form in which I need to write my name and when did I went to Wuhan, which train did I take, when did I came back, etc. Later, they tested my temperature for 3 or 4 times during the ride from Hebei to Beijing. When I came back to my community, again, I filled in a form about my basic information related to the Wuhan trip and get my temperature tested. So according to the requirement from the government, I can go to work from next Monday. But my problem is, I don't have enough masks. I don't have 3 or 4 right now at home, and I couldn't find any in drugstores or online apps. So that's another problem, because I don't know how long I need to keep staying at home and cannot go outside because of the shortages of masks.
We're also seeing a shortage of masks here in Hong Kong. Is Beijing facing the same problem?
Yes, I went to, because there are several drugstores near my neighborhood. So I went to check 2 or 3. All of them don't have the masks. It's such a problem right now for so many people.
Are we seeing any solutions to this right now? Because I know that, for example, the Shanghai government, they've announced that they will distribute masks to every household. Is the Beijing government doing anything similar?
I don't know what the government is doing in Beijing. What I can see, what people are doing around me, like my friends and residents in my neighborhood, they just try to find masks from other places.
So Echo, 2 weeks in Hebei, 2 weeks in Beijing, in quarantine. How are you able to practice your journalism on the ground? Tell us, what is the best story you're doing right now?
Right now, I'm doing a story on the wildlife trade in China. I'm really interested in it because I think it's such a big problem right now for China, because China, it wants to ban the wildlife trade. But after talking to interviewees, especially those environmentalists and professors on the environmental protection, and after did so much research, I realized it is really hard for the government to have a complete ban on the commercial use of wild animals.
And why would that be?
First of all, the breeding industry is a very large industry in China. And I just saw some data from the government-backed organization, and there are millions of people working in this industry, and it's a very large industry. And the problem is there are so many loopholes in the law. For example, in China, it has animals under special state protection, but the more than 1,000 species are not under protected, which includes rats, bats and crows. For those animals which are underprotected, more than 1,000 species, they are legal for commercial uses and for trade.
So, you know, here in Hong Kong, after the bird flu, actually the Hong Kong government demanded a complete ban of selling of live chickens in wet markets here. Are we seeing any similar approaches being adopted in Beijing?
Yes, not only in Beijing, in a lot of cities in China, including Beijing, Guangzhou, Wuhan, for example, a lot of the wet markets are closed and the wildlife markets are closed, and live chickens are banned from transported to those markets. But my question is, these are just the measures taken during the outbreak of the virus. So what would the government do after the outbreak? Because we know that when the SARS outbreak in 2003, the government took similar measures, but just a month later, everything went back to normal and people started eating cuisines and animals again. So I just don't know if this crisis might make a change for the Chinese people, for their eating habits. So I feel it's just so interesting that like there's so many 吃货 in China.
For those who don't speak Chinese, Echo, can you explain what 吃货 is?
People prefer to eat cuisines, to eat delicious food. So basically it means people loves eating.
Basically a foodie then.
Echo, your second round of quarantine ends this Monday. What are you looking forward the most to do right after this?
I really want to go outside because I stayed at home for such a long time and I started worried about my health right now.
And what do you want to do the most when you go outside?
Jogging maybe, going to the parks, to some places that don't have so many people.
Basically just hang out then. I hope you get some sunshine and thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
In our last episode, you heard about the video lectures being delivered for Hong Kong University students. Right now, there are hundreds of thousands of students across mainland China who are about to travel back from their New Year holiday to continue their studies in Hong Kong, Australia, Europe, and the US. One of those students is in an apartment building in Xi'an. Now, there is a famous saying in China about Xi'an. It goes like this. To experience 10 years of China, go to Shenzhen. To experience 100 years of China, go to Shanghai. To experience 1,000 years of China, go to Beijing.
要看2000年的中国,去西安.
But to experience 2,000 years of China, go to Xi'an.
Imagine you are a university student living in an apartment building and you get told someone in your building is suspected of carrying coronavirus. This is what happened to a student named Carol Yuan 5 days ago in Xi'an.
At the night of February 14th, our community announced that there is a suspected case in our building. So they have to block one side of the building because like one building have two different sides and they are separate. So they block our side. So the next day we found a cordon is put up at the entrance of the building. So there are staff on duty 24 hours to prevent anyone from entering or leaving.
How did you get by with meeting your daily needs, like getting food, getting your groceries to your apartment?
So actually it's very interesting because we have two different ways to get necessities. So first one is we need to ask our friends or call delivery service to send the items to the property office and the staff will send them to the household door to door. But it's a little bit inconvenient. So we came up with another way. We hang a plastic rope from our window because we live on the third floor. It's very low. So we hang a plastic rope from our window and our friends in the garden tie the box or bags to the rope and then we pull it out.
That is so old-fashioned. And how long do you think, do you guys expect you'll be locked down inside?
It should be 14 days.
When was the last time you went outside the building?
Actually, I went back home at the end of January. So I didn't go out since I arrived home because I don't need to go out.
That's a lot of time being stuck inside an apartment. How do you spend your day? What's your routines like?
I just stay at home, like do some homework or online class.
So you're a student at one of the university here in Hong Kong. Can you tell me what they told you about classes or the arrangement for this semester?
The university just said they will continue to apply online teaching until further notice. So I have all my class online, yeah.
So when this all comes to an end, when you are allowed to leave your building again, what would be the first thing you would do?
I think I would like to get a cup of bubble tea or eat hot pot or something, yeah.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being with us, Carol. And wish you guys best of luck and stay healthy during this time.
Okay, thank you.
Now, finally, to Hong Kong and the ongoing panic buying in supermarkets. Last week, you heard from Masato Kajimoto from the University of Hong Kong talking about what the World Health Organization calls an infodemic, an epidemic of bad or false information on social media that has created waves of panic here in Hong Kong, leading people to frantically buying particular items like toilet paper, bleach, rice, and canned food. Dr. Richard Clayton is a management psychology and behavioral specialist here in Hong Kong. And he's identified a very particular type of issue happening in Hong Kong right now. And it's all about trust.
So the author, Rachel Botsman, talks about three different types of trust that have evolved through the ages. The first is localized trust. This is when you trust your local community, your friends and your neighbors. This is really not something that happens in urban communities anymore. Secondly, there's institutional trust. This is when you trust things like the government and educational institutes or even private institutions to tell you what's going on in the world. The third one is distributed trust. This is the idea that you trust ratings across digital platforms where people say, this is something that's good, other people rate it as good as well, and you trust the aggregate of that rating.
And here's why he thinks trust is breaking down in Hong Kong.
The coronavirus has illustrated the tension between institutionalized and distributed trust in Hong Kong in the following ways. Firstly, you've got the problem of trusting the government in Hong Kong and the government in China. So Hong Kong people have experienced SARS and experienced the Chinese government keeping SARS under wraps for a long period of time, which resulted in infections in Hong Kong that might not have happened otherwise. It seems like similar things happened early on in the coronavirus outbreak, where a whistleblower was saying that infections and pneumonia were happening in Wuhan and was shut down by the local government and the police. So you can understand perhaps why Hong Kong is not trusting the Beijing government. Because of the protests since July in Hong Kong as well, you've got distrust of the local government. So Hong Kongers aren't even trusting their own government to tell them the truth about what is going on. This is sort of the perfect storm. So Hong Kongers aren't trusting the national government or the local government, which is resulting in a number of dysfunctional behaviours across the society.
Mimi, do you trust the ratings you see online?
Sometimes, but I'm sceptical. It depends the kind of mood I'm in. But I will always trust movie ratings on Douban.com from the mainland. They've got pretty spot on review and rating score for movies.
Here's what Dr. Clayton has to say about that and why trust is breaking down right now.
Yes, so there's sort of two forms of distributed trust. One, where there's no emotive content, which you can sort of trust. The idea you would choose an Uber driver with 5 stars over an Uber driver with 4 stars, for example, or an Airbnb accommodation with 4.5 stars over one with 4.2. So you can sort of trust this stuff when there's not an emotive content. But with the coronavirus, because it's so emotive and because there's a lack of institutional trust, the distributed trust channels like YouTube or WhatsApp or any of these digital platforms are not necessarily giving you the best information. Yeah. So they say to you the government's not telling you the truth or it's hiding things. And you, as a critical thinker, someone who's special and not going with the herd, are going to them to find out what the real truth is. In the local level in Hong Kong, where people are stripping the shelves bare of toilet paper, tissue paper, pasta and noodles, you're seeing the worst case scenario spreading through digital platforms. People are looking at it and go, we might not have any food, despite institutions saying, no, we're fine, we do have enough. And this is a challenge. So rather than the coronavirus necessarily being the most scary thing, it's the public reaction that should cause you a bit of fear. Because if they keep on stripping the shelves and supply chains do fail, then we have a really serious problem.
As always, remember this is a story that is developing every day. For the latest updates, go to scmp.com for our 24-hour rolling coverage. My name is Mimi Lau.
And I'm Kinling Lo. Remember, wash your hands.
And to stay active and stay safe.
For more podcasts from the South China Morning Post, head to scmp.com, where you can hear more about technology, trade, culture, and society.